Chapter 34, It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 34. Commission grinds on slow. Beginning of since the various members of the United States delegation have been assigned certain aspects of the testimony to study and summarize into report. As the testimony of the commission has gathered covers, as the testimony gathered covers over 20,000 pages, no one man can be familiar, but one can master a section of it and be ready to argue any point in it when the conclusions are on and the record made. Psi and Ace, the case of Slavia, only that relates to the Macedonian problem. Norbert has Albania. Harry Howard, Bulgaria. For the first weeks, they did practically nothing except pour 20,000 pages of testimony, telling the fact that the problem delegates were working in somewhat similar fashion, but none except Russia was working in such a detailed way. Most of them didn't have large enough delegations to split them into committees. Finally, when the summaries on the various aspects of the investigation are finished, the drafting committee begins the long, tedious task of agreeing on the essential facts to include in the report for the Security Council. Now, offhand, perhaps, it doesn't seem difficult to agree on facts. It is not only difficult, it is also impossible. It is almost impossible. The delegates of the 11 nations do not, of course, see eye to eye, and so, naturally, they interpret facts differently. Generally speaking, England, the United States, Belgium, France, Colombia, Syria, Australia, Brazil, and China have the same point of view. Russia and Poland the exact opposite. So day after day, the 11 talk, argue, wrangle, hoping to come finally to the same set of facts. At last, the factual part of the report is finished, and the much more trying job of drawing conclusions from the facts begins. This is really awful, or so they tell me. Even France, Belgium, and Colombia, who agree almost 100 facts in the reports, don't believe the Commission has the right to draw conclusions. That, they argue, should be left to the Security Council. And, of course, Russia and Poland don't hold for a minute with conclusions. After conclusions, work begins on recommendations. This is the final phase. The United States delegates begin to perk up. They believe now they will actually get home by the 4th of July. They talk more lightly. They laugh more freely. They attend a round of farewell parties. Mr. and Mrs. Lavrishchev and the other members of the Russian delegation give a dinner at Oviv, a restaurant that sits high on a hill on the opposite shore of Lake Geneva, from where we live, and grows thousands of tulips to burst like Roman candles in a celebration of spring down the long green slopes of the lawn to the water's edge. It is the hour of sunset when we meet the Russians, and the sky behind the hills on our Eden side of Lake Geneva looks as if all the watermelons in Georgia had broken over it, piling the silvery pink pulp carelessly against the blue. I want to point it out to my host and hostess, but their English is very limited, and my Russian is nil. The Colombian delegation, Francisco José Urrutia, who is his country's minister to Belgium, secretly coaches me in French. Sunset, couche du soleil, he says patiently, is very beautiful, et très joli. Since Mr. Doe is not present to make fun of me, I spring this line on Mr. Lavrishchev. La couche du soleil est très jolie. His small gray eyes twinkle, and he answers in French that I am an amazing linguist. I speak Georgian, English, and now French. And the worst of all three is her English, says Sai, chuckling from across the table. The only reason she speaks English as well as she does is because it is kin in some respects to the Georgian dialect. Mr. Lavrishchev loves this kidding. Out of a committee room, he is as human as an organ grinder's pet bear. He listens sympathetically to you when you talk, and when he talks, he does it enthusiastically. He likes to tell stories, especially long stories from his favorite Russian author, Chekhov. He tells them in Russian, and an assistant on his delegation, S.M. Kudryavtsev, translates them sentence by sentence. Sometimes one story takes 30 or 40 minutes, but they are so good, no one minds. But he does have one short story which he first told when he and Mr. Wendell were having a heated dispute over the testimony of the Greek guerrilla leader, Marcos. One of the teams of the commission set out from Salonika one March day to see Marcos at a definitely appointed time and at a definitely designated spot. But for some reason, Marcos failed to keep the appointment. Mr. Wendell, Sam Inglese, the Syrian, Brian Johnston, the Australian, Ace Miller, and several other members of the group waited for 24 hours and then returned to Salonika. But the Russians and Poles hung around until Marcos finally showed up. In Geneva, Mr. Lavrishchev wanted to include Marcos's remarks in the official testimony gathered by the commission, and Mr. Wendell violently objected. For hours, the argument raged. Mr. Lavrishchev contended that Marcos had not intended any disrespect to the commission, that there had been a slip-up somewhere, and he had not been informed of the team's visit. Mr. Wendell, on the other hand, insisted that Marcos did know of the engagement and that he had even sent the correct number of mules, which he had agreed to send to a certain village to meet there. Mr. Lavrishchev said anyone could have arranged for the mules, even the British delegate himself. And then he told his mule story. There was a Russian peasant traveling from his village on muleback to another village some distance away, when suddenly his mule went lame. Fortunately, the peasant was near the home of a friend who had a mule, so he went to his friend and asked him to lend him his mule to continue his journey. The friend said he would like very much to lend him his mule, but unhappily his mule was in the mountains grazing on a grassy slope. It would take the best part of a day to catch him, so the loan was out of the question. The peasant started away, but had gone only a few steps when he heard a mule braying behind the friend's barn. Quickly he turned back and said, "Why, listen, I hear your mule braying right there in the lot." To which the friend calmly answered, "Whom do you believe, me or my mule?" By request, Mr. Lavrishchev tells this story again at dinner, his round moonlight face wreathed in smiles. For the thousandth time, I think how pleasant individual Russians are when they are out from under the thumb of the Politburo. When I am with them, I can never make myself believe that they are guilty of the brutal acts which are plainly in the records. Mr. Lavrishchev, for instance, is head of the Balkan section of the Soviet Union's Foreign Office and is credited with having organized the Fatherland Front, which rules Bulgaria, as I have already said, so ruthlessly that its people court has killed officially 2,525 and unofficially 30,000 or more anti-communists. And Mr. Kudryavtsev, according to my personal sluice, was one of the leading operators of the Canadian atomic bomb ring. Yet here they both sit at dinner, cordial, charming, witty. Surely, if they were not possessing communist mania, they would be as amenable in their official roles as they are in their social contacts. We have a delicious dinner which, with wines for all courses and so many different toasts, we are constantly jumping up and sitting down until we finally decide to have a seventh inning, as in baseball, and drink at once to everybody. When the toast died down, all the guests except Mr. Lavrishchev dance. He sits and signals with his big head at the women with whom the other Russians are to dance, or so the United States delegates tell me on the way home when I'm boasting over the number of times Mr. Kudryavtsev danced with me, and always, by coincidence, to Henry Pritchard's song, "Kentucky," one of the most frequently played numbers in Geneva. If Switzerland had Your Hit Parade, all the tunes would be American and Kentucky would be the number one choice. Besides the Russians' farewell dinner, the Australians and Brazilians and the United States delegates give luncheons, and the Chinese and the Secretariat give cocktail parties, and other people give other functions. But I will only take up mouthful by mouthful the Australians, for after all, I don't want this book to turn into a debutante's diary. The Australians, though, was so typically a Swiss luncheon party as I saw them, I feel I must tell about it. A. As the delegates constantly said, as they began an exposition of facts, the luncheon is at La Perle du Lac restaurant built on the edge of Lake Geneva in the style of a Swiss chalet. The outside board stained brown, the narrow balcony with its gaily cut out banisters jutting from the second floor, and the bonnet looking roof extending out over all of it. B. The cocktails before lunch are martinis, which are 5/6 vermouth and 1/6 gin, and are served on the tiny balcony with the smoke-colored water at our feet, and the candelabra branches of the horse chestnuts almost touching our heads and shoulders. C. Pink carnations, their stems wrapped in silk, are folded inside the women's napkins. This, as I come to think of it, is perhaps a Brian Johnston touch from below the equator, for I don't recall it at other Swiss luncheons. D. The hors d'oeuvres are a full meal all by themselves. I counted 21 separate dishes, and cans for some were served in the cans in which they came. But now, my memory being what it is, I can remember only 15. Ham, salami, rolled chip beef, celery roots, beets, dark red beans that look similar to pork and beans, sardines, tuna fish, anchovies, olives, stuffed eggs, coleslaw, tomatoes, long yellowish green beans, and little pickled onions. E. The main course is pork chops and a thick sauce. It could have been steak or veal chops and been just as Swiss. And canned peas cooked as an extra party touch with shreds of spinach and, of course, French fried potatoes. F. And for dessert, ice cream with fresh strawberries and whipped cream, followed by coffee and more whipped cream. Is it any wonder that I leave Geneva 15 pounds heavier than I was when I entered? The day arrives when the commission figures there are only two more Sundays before it can shake the dust of Geneva. This is purely a figure of speech. There is no dust in Switzerland, for it rains frequently, but gently, off its feet. For the first time, the United States delegates see their way clear to take Sundays off. On one of them, we board a lake steamer around noon and cut swiftly through the water from town to town until we come to the impressive city of Lausanne. For several hours, we climb the steep hills, stare up at its magnificent old cathedral, study its far-spreading university buildings, peer at the innumerable beautiful articles in its shop windows, priced much lower than in the tourist city of Geneva. It's the old greenfields theory cropping up. And then catch one of the Switzerland's fastest, always on time, spotlessly clean electric trains back to Geneva. The last Sunday, we go, again by steamer, past Laon to Montreux, at the far end of Lake Geneva, where the Elephantine Mountains, with their trappings of snow-sequined in sun, shove their gray hooves into the water and their heads and haunches into the sky. We have brunch at a sidewalk cafe, which is more confusing than a riot. Swiss hikers in those heavy, spiked, ankle-high shoes, knapsacks bulging with narcissuses slung across their backs, tramp around us. The brightly uniformed members of a band, the bass horn holding the sun, march past to their Sunday afternoon concert. Taxi drivers crank their taxis and dribble off. Tourists stumble over to buy postal cards. Bicyclist whizzed by. Lunch over, and for once, I have no idea what we ate. We take a lunch at the Castle of Chillon, about which Byron wrote The Prisoner of Chillon. It is a perfect medieval castle rising sheer out of the lake with all the knightly accoutrements. A moat, a drawbridge, a baronial dining hall, a dungeon or two, a round tower where a princess could grow old and die before her Prince Charming ever found her. For it is flights and flights of narrow, dangerous steps above the world. Tiny slit windows, 3 foot thick walls, creeping vines. We tramp over every room and passageway of it, with Cy reading aloud to us from a tourist pamphlet and Harry making wisecracks. Next, we catch the funicular that creeps like a caterpillar almost straight up the side of a mountain. I don't like it. I'm afraid it might flip over on its back at any moment and crash down into the lake. The scenery, though, is breathtaking, or it would be breathtaking if the danger of the climb hadn't already taken it. Mountains keep poking their circus tent tops above the circus tent tops of other mountains. The whole dome of the city is jagged and slit as a gypsy dancer's skirt. Our train stops at the resort town of Co, which is below the snow line this time of year, and for an hour or two, we who have strength walk in the meadows, picking wildflowers, and those who haven't the strength sit on the terrace of a hotel and drink hot chocolate and eat sweet cakes. The wildflowers are thick in the tall grasses. Jean, with the aid of George M. Erminger, picks 27 varieties, and I, an individualist with the aid of no one, pick 18. After the walk, all of us, the flower pickers and the chocolate sippers, sit quietly on the shelf of Co, halfway between the valley where Lake Geneva lies, as softly curved as a tossed aside blue fox cape on Milady's chaise long, and the mountain heights behind us. We feel sad and insignificant and futile. At least I do, and I always make the mistake of thinking everyone feels as I do. It is as near the top of the mountain as I have been, and I experience no temptation other than the desire to crawl into a hole. The report is finished. All that remains is a signing of it by the delegates. This is to be public. At noon on the day, the 11 representatives of the 11 nations gather around a large horseshoe table in that beautiful and historic chamber in which Russia was kicked out of the old League of Nations when her armies invaded Finland, and behind them sit their assistants, and in front of them, in the seats of the public, sit the newspapermen and wives and other interested people. The ceremony is simple. Mr. Mendez Viana, who has been rotated into the chairmanship at this hour, thanks his fellow delegates for their long and conscientious labor in a most difficult assignment, and then he passes part one and part two of the report, which deal with the factual findings from member to member. All 11 representatives sign. The conclusions outlined in part three are circulated next. They assert that Greece's three northern neighbors, Albania, Bulgaria, and Yugoslavia, have encouraged, trained, and supplied the Greek guerrillas in their armed activities against the Greek government. 8 nations, the United States, China, Australia, Syria, Brazil, Belgium, and Colombia sign, but Belgium and Colombia insert a reservation that they agree that the facts lead to the conclusions arrived at. They are not sure the Commission has the right to draw conclusions. France abstains, and Russia and Poland dissent in conclusions of their own, which put all of the blame for conditions in Greece upon the reactionary Greece government, clearing Albania, Bulgaria of all guilt. Last, the recommendation of the Security Council on the table. There are 5 of them, A, B, C, D, and E, but the most vital is C. Quote, A body should be established by the Security Council either in the form of a small commission or a single commissioner for the purpose of investigating frontier violations, hearing complaints, using its good offices, making studies and investigations, and reporting to the Security Council. 9 sign the recommendations. Russia and Poland again dissent. The commission's work in Geneva is finished. The delegates will have to present the report to the Security Council at Lake Success, but their investigation job is ended. And with the end of the commission's job, my holiday is over. I begin to pack, pay up bills, and talk about returning my bicycle to the shop from which I rented it, but I forget it until it is too late and have to ask the concierge at the Eden to return it for me. Oh, stars, I mourn to the roommate. I hope that bicycle man won't dash around here and throw me into jail. Well, says the roommate, I trust it will be in solitary. My feelings on leaving Geneva are mixed up, as they were when I graduated from Wesleyan. I'm nostalgic over leaving Europe and excited over getting home. I'm full of regrets for lost opportunities. I wish I had studied more, listened more, done without more, suffered more. Europe is a tragic land, cold, hungry, afraid, and tortured. And yet I, as a privileged person, the wife of a temporary United States diplomat, was always physically comfortable, well-fed, cared for, and safe. The heartaches of the Greeks, of the Bulgarians, of the Yugoslavs, and of all the other people of Eastern Europe, I knew only by the pain in their eyes and their hunger, by the hollows in their cheeks, their discouragements, by the slump of their shoulders, the drag of their feet, the terrors, by the tremors of apprehension across their faces, and the terrible palsy of their blue-veined hands. I had not actually shared any of their agony, not the way I share the agony of Mr. Big when he sticks a rusty nail deep into his foot. Is it any wonder that the world is Greek to me? End of chapter 34 and end of the book, It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge.